Jericho versus Rourke in a bare-knuckle brawl at WrestleMania. Now, that was money. Grasping my opportunity, I replied instantly, a boxing match, huh? King muttered, ah, here he goes. But Rourke backtracked and tried to end the segment by calling me brother and wishing me luck at Mania. I didn't have much time as the segment was ending, so I made one more last-ditch effort. Like I said, Mr. Rourke, was I on Fantasy Island now? You may respect me and what I do, but I don't have respect for you. I really don't. Rourke's demeanor changed slightly, and I knew I'd gotten him. He was pissed off. I'd barged in during his interview and completely ignored his apology and his attempts to play nice. I'd punked him out and disrespected him to his face on live national TV, and there was nothing he could do about it.
I'm going to take the high road, brother, and wish you luck. You go do your thing.
But I'd drawn blood, so I stayed on him, reminding him of his boxing match or bare-knuckle fight challenge. I'll be here, Mr. Rourke, waiting. You know where to find me. But be careful what you wish for, because it may come true. Rourke was over being nice and was stewing as Larry told me to have a good night and enjoy Metallica. Just as we went off the air, Rourke threw out a thinly veiled insult with a straight-faced glare. You're looking sharp tonight, Chris. Something you would say when you're about to take the first swing and start a barroom blitz. When I reminded him I was waiting, his retort was simple and direct. Have a good night, son. Aha! He called me son, which was one step away from calling me boy, the ultimate manly cut down. Had I been sitting next to him in Larry's studio, I think Mickey would have taken a swing at me, and that was good enough for me, even though I hadn't been able to get him to agree to a match. Mission accomplished. The next day, I asked Vince what he thought, and he said both he and WWE executive producer Kevin Dunn thought I'd been a little too stiff on Mickey. Once you knew he wasn't going to take the match, you should have smiled and let him off the hook. I disagreed and was very satisfied with how I'd stayed in character and hadn't let him off the hook. But I still wanted to thank Mickey for the segment and asked Flair for his number. Flair texted me back and said that I could send all messages to Rourke through him. I found it kind of strange that he wouldn't give me his digits himself, but I wrote a text thanking him and forwarded it over to Rick anyway. I never heard back from him, but I later found out that was because the last thing Mickey wanted from me was a thank you. What he wanted was my head on a platter. After the Rourke confrontation, I took Larry's advice and enjoyed Metallica. They put on an amazing show as always, and afterward I was escorted back to the dressing room area for the VIP afterparty. I was a little nervous as they were one of my top three all-time favorite bands. Do you know the other two? Answer at the end of this chapter. And I'd never really met any of them before. Would they be in a bad mood, or would it be the greatest moment of my life? They always say you should never meet your idols because they may disappoint you, but I was ready to take the chance. The room was crowded with fans, friends, and dignitaries. Where's your crown, King Jericho? All waiting to say a few words to the band. I noticed guitarist Kirk Hammett, who I'd kind of met once before in 1994 in Atlanta. I had asked him to sign the cast on my broken arm. I'd broken it trying a shooting star press in Knoxville. And he said he would if I could use his boner as a speed bump. I'm still not sure what he was getting at, and he wasn't either when I asked about it 14 years later in Chicago. He said, laughing, I was really drunk on Frangelico that night. I could relate, considering I had crashed my car and split open my forehead whilst under the influence of said spirit in Calgary back in 1995. Full versions of both of these stories are available in my book of medieval poetry entitled A Lion's Tale, available at a Renaissance fair near you. Then I saw Lars Ulrich, and he was even friendlier. The thing I love about Lars is, when you talk to him, he seems really interested and engaged in the conversation. He'll stand there, head cocked like a cocker spaniel, eyes locked on yours, paying attention to every word you're saying. It also seems that he has a story to tell about every city in the world. You're from Winnipeg? River City, right? Cool, that's the home of the Golden Boy. I checked it out once back in 89. I went into total fanboy mode and told him how much I'd loved them since I was a teenager as he looked on and nodded with a smile. I asked him if he was sick of hearing people say such things, and he replied, In the 90s I was, but now I realize how much of an honor it is to mean so much to people and have such a special place in their lives. It was a really interesting thing to hear, because I feel the same way. Whenever somebody recognizes me and tells me how big a fan they are, or says thanks for all the years of entertainment, I never take that for granted. It really makes me happy to know that I have made somebody's life a little better and means the world to me to hear it. As a matter of fact, if you ever see me on the street and want to say hi, please do. Tell me Chris sent you. I shot the shit with Lars about our favorite heavy metal bands for a few minutes until I saw the man I'd been waiting to meet for 25 years walk into the room. The mighty Hetfield had arrived. Ever since I started listening to Metallica in 1984, I'd been enamored of one James Allen Hetfield, the leader, the singer, the main songwriter, and the fruitiest-looking guy I'd ever seen, especially after Cliff Burton died in 1986. I had always related to James's lyrics and knew he'd grown up in a broken home with a sick mother the same way I did. I felt the same pain and in turn was able to harness all the emotions I felt after my parents' divorce and my mom's crippling accident by finding solace in their music. I'd been a diehard fan since the day I first heard them, and my commitment to the band had never wavered through any of the band's phases. I remember going into Records on Wheels. There used to be these things called record stores, kids, in 1984, and looking at the back of the Kill 'Em All album, at the picture of the four scruffy-looking bums with zits and teenage mustaches, and liking them instantly. Because they looked just like me. Since that day, Metallica were my indispensable heroes, my gods that never failed, my phantom lords. And James was their leader. And now he was standing only a few feet away from me. I'd been in this position before when I met Wayne Gretzky in 2002, scared and nervous to approach him, but dead set on doing so. However, Hetfield was different. He was, well, he was James Hetfield. I didn't want to come off like a blathering fanboy, but how could I not? I was going to have to play this one fruitly. I approached him slowly and quietly, like Steve Irwin advancing toward a rare poisonous snake.
Crikey, here is the elusive Hetfieldus Maximus, only seen in the catacombs of arenas worldwide. Approach slowly, or he will growl in your face and disappear back into hiding. Crikey, crikey!
He glanced at me as I got closer, and I knew I'd reached the point of no return. Hey, James, I said calmly. I'm Chris Jericho. Nice to meet you, man. Hey, I know who you are, he said with a smile.
Wow. James knew who I was?
That was an unexpected plus. This was going to be easy. Then my mind went blank. I felt like I should say something, but I had no idea what. I couldn't wipe the stupid grin off my face or stop shaking his hand. It was awkward and uncomfortable, and after being in the public eye for 20 years with millions of fans of my own, I was now totally starstruck. James knew it too, and thankfully broke the silence.
Did you have a good time tonight?
That was all it took to break the floodgates open. I told him that I'd had a blast and proceeded to say everything I'd wanted to tell him since I was 13 years old. How much Metallica's music had meant to me, how much I related to his lyrics and his story, how he and his band had helped me through so many hard times, how much I admired him as a person for turning his life around in a positive way. After a 5-minute soliloquy, I finally got around to saying what I really wanted to say. I just want to thank you for all you've done for me. James continued to smile as he nodded his head and thanked me right back. My confession finished, I put my arm around him and Spee-Wee snapped a picture. I said thanks again and took my leave. Trying to stay fruit, I headed toward an empty corner of the room on trembling legs. When I was sure no one could see me, I put my hands on the wall to brace myself and took a deep breath. My heart was pounding and I felt like I was going to cry because no matter how much I've done or how many places I've been, I'm still a fan. That's why meeting James for the first time was one of the best moments of my life. And the memory remains. Chapter 16. Rookie, the Dagger Sweatboat. After my appearance on Larry King as a straight-up heel, Mickey Rourke never responded to my text Flair had forwarded to him. Plus, Vince and Kevin were annoyed at me, and I received tons of backlash from fans via emails and social media posts. Due to the deluge of insults and disrespect I showed him, people felt sorry for poor old Mickey and felt I had gone too far. I disagreed and thought I deserved an Emmy for my acting performance, even though nobody seemed to understand or appreciate my dedication to the craft. Nobody, that is, except the William Morris Agency, only the biggest talent agency in Hollywood. A few of their top guys had seen me on King and wanted to take a meeting with me immediately. I'd had a few agents during my flirtations with acting, but none of them came close to the size or prestige of William Morris. This was my big break. Wait until Hollywood got a load of me. I was ready for my close-up. I was completely wrong, and my delusions of grandeur were shattered like rolling stones when I went for my big meeting to find out that William Morris had no intention of bringing me in as a client. The agents just wanted to meet me and get a few pictures for their kids because they were big fans of my work in the WWE. Ugh. In the words of Ron Simmons, I could have just mailed them a fucking autograph. When the whole Rourke match fell through, Vince switched over to Plan B. One of his favorite mottos was, "Always turn a negative into a positive." And that's exactly what he planned to do. He pitched a scenario where I would continue comparing Flair's career with that of Randy the Ram, except now I wouldn't just be insulting Flair, but all of the other aging legendary WWE superstars who were still a part of the company. Vince's criteria for the legends I'd be antagonizing were: A, they had to be in the WWE Hall of Fame, and B, they had to have competed at the first WrestleMania. Using those guidelines, his idea was I would end up in a 3-on-1 handicap match at WrestleMania 25 against Roddy Piper, Jimmy Snuka, and Greg Valentine. It seemed like an interesting plan, not as much of a main event spot as the Rourke scenario, but still an attraction all the same. As a matter of fact, to the fans in the WWE universe, the handicap match would probably mean more than the Rourke match anyway. The only problem I could see was the quality of the bout. While Piper, Snuka, and Valentine were all good workers in their prime, none of the three moved all that well in 2009. I knew that while the build-up would be great, the match itself had the potential to be rotten. When I told Vince the match might not be good, his response was classic. "The match isn't supposed to be good." Maybe so, but this was WrestleMania we were talking about, and I wanted to have the best match possible. So I suggested we use Jerry Lawler instead of Valentine. Lawler had been lobbying for a Mania match for years, and this would be perfect, because not only could he still work, he was one of the best talkers of all time. But Vince shot it down instantly, because Lawler hadn't wrestled in the first WrestleMania. Now, keep in mind, these were McMahon's self-imposed rules. We'd never mentioned them in any way on Raw, so it's not like there were any real restrictions in place. Vince could put whoever he wanted in the match, but in his mind they had to fit that exact criteria. So then I thought about suggesting Tito Santana, but after some brainstorming I had an even better idea. Ricky Steamboat. Ricky was the perfect third man. He'd just returned to the WWE as a producer, had wrestled in the first WrestleMania, was about to be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame that year, was one of the greatest workers in the history of the business, and was one of my biggest influences. I mentioned his name, and I could see by the look on Vince's face that he thought the idea might work. But there was one major problem. Does he own his name? I'm not sure of the specifics, but apparently when Ricky got divorced, his ex-wife somehow ended up with the rights to the name Ricky Steamboat and kept it. Ricky hadn't wrestled in years, but if he ever decided to get back in the ring, it seemed he'd have to change his name to Rookie the Dagger Sweatboat, or Rocky the Dragon Steamfloat. So even though Vince liked the idea, we had to obtain further nomenclature knowledge about Ricky before he would sign off on it. After a few days of waiting, word came back that Ricky had indeed reacquired the rights to his name and was Steamboat once again. So at WrestleMania 25, it was going to be Chris Jericho versus Roddy Piper, Jimmy Snuka, and Ricky Steamboat with Ric Flair in their corner. A pretty great group of guys to build a storyline with. Plus, I was getting the chance to work with one of my all-time heroes, and I knew that Steamboat, in his 50s, was still going to be better than a lot of the current roster. The plan was I would confront one of the legends every week and bury them to where they would have no choice but to accept my challenge for the handicap match. I was so sure of my abilities as the best in the world that I felt I could beat all three has-beens at the same time. Another character might have gotten cheers with these boasts, but not me. I was such a piece of shit at this point that the fans wanted to see the old-timers take me down and shut me up. The first confrontation was with Roddy Piper on Raw in Spokane, Washington. I was going to tell him how his time had come, and now it was time for him to disappear forever. But before the show, when we were going over the promo, I gave him one request. Roddy, when we do this tonight, I want you to forget about the Roddy Piper who tells jokes and talks in funny voices. I want the Roddy Piper who made the first WrestleMania such a success. The rat bastard who made Hulk Hogan a superstar, and who gets no credit for making that show what it was. I really believed that. If it wasn't for Piper being such a strong heel, Hogan would have had nobody to go after. Nobody for the fans to rally behind him to beat. Piper took my advice and later that night delivered one of the best promos I've ever heard from him. No jokes, no comedy. Just a straight-from-the-heart, kick-ass dissertation from one of the best ever. He dressed me down by saying that I had once reminded him of himself, but now I had become insufferable and boorish. He stood up for Flair and Rourke, explaining that Mickey's performance in The Wrestler wasn't about an old-timer trying to get one last run. It was about doing what you love to do and enjoying the thrill of performing. He explained that guys like him, Flair and all of the legends, had respect and love for the fans, while I had neither. Then, with a tear in his eye, he explained how people came up to him and reminisced about watching his matches with their families, their parents and grandparents who had passed away, and how I was trying to bury those moments instead of celebrating them. Roddy never raised his voice or pandered to the crowd. As far as he was concerned, it was just him and me in that arena. He delivered a riveting performance and absolutely nailed it. He had crib notes on his wrist tape, but I let that slide. Finishing up with a serious delivery of his new catchphrase, "Old school's cool." He went to shake my hand as the crowd chanted, "Hot Rod, Hot Rod," and I looked remorsefully at the ground. Then I kicked him in the knee and proceeded to beat the shit out of him. The silent crowd that had been sucked in by Roddy's performance now erupted in a tidal wave of boos. "You want respect?" I yelled at him as he rolled around on the mat in pain. "Roll around, Piper! Roll around!" I kept shouting as the fans continued yelling their disapproval. I walked up the ramp to the top of the stage, relaxed my face, adjusted my suit and tie, and smirked. It was such a smarmy way to end the segment, and the perfect demonstration of the dickery, is that a word, of Jericho. Next up was Jimmy Superfly Snuka. Snuka was almost a mythical figure in the WWE, a dynamic performer who had captivated fans for years with his high-flying moves. He was even directly responsible for Mick Foley. Did you know Mick has never beaten me in an officially sanctioned match? Wanting to be a pro wrestler. But Superfly had deteriorated quite a bit from his glory days, and while he still wrestled on the indie circuit, was now a shell of his former self. However, he was still a beloved character in the WWE universe, and the perfect target for evil Jericho. One of Snuka's most famous moments was when he was beaten down with a coconut by Roddy on the set of Piper's Pit 25 years earlier. And to play off that historic moment, the WWE was promoting a rare Piper's Pit on Raw with Superfly as the guest. The famous pit set had been assembled on the stage, and the crowd cheered vociferously, big word alert, when Piper's famed bagpipe intro hit. Those cheers turned to jeers when I strolled out to the stage instead. I had hijacked the segment to inform Snuka that he was just as washed up as the rest of the so-called legends in the WWE. Jimmy was never much of a talker, and as his age progressed, he became harder to understand. At this point, the majority of his communication skills consisted mostly of him flashing the "I love you" sign, a.k.a. the Dio horns, while vacantly smiling and saying, "It's all about the love, brudda." The segment was designed for me to do most of the talking, so I taunted him about being washed up and threatened to hit him with some fruit, not F-R-O-O-T, of my own. I pulled out a bunch of bananas and two coconuts and waved them in his face, taunting and punking him out until he batted them from my hands and got in my grill. I slowly backed down and skulked away, tail between my legs, leaving Jimmy to bask in the glory of his fans. He went down on his knees and hit his signature pose, arms extended with both hands holding up the horns. Meanwhile, I had circled around behind the pit set, waiting for my cue. When Snuka stood up, I was going to push the set down on him and attack. So I waited and waited, but Jimmy never stood up. He continued posing on his knees, and the camera stayed on him far too long. This was known as an angle alert, a situation where it becomes way too obvious to the fans that something is going to happen. I'm not sure if he went blank, zoned out, or just decided he didn't feel like standing up again. But I couldn't wait around for him any longer. I pushed the balsa wood set onto his back, and he went down like a ton of bricks. And I ain't talking about Middle Church. It looked really lame, since hitting him with that flimsy wall was about as dangerous as being hit with a toilet paper roll. But it did the trick, and the crowd gasped incredulously, not believing that I would stoop so low as to attack Jimmy Snuka from behind. But I was about to stoop a lot lower, so I bashed him with the pieces of the lethal balsa wood. I slowly took off my jacket and unbuttoned my shirt sleeves to illustrate that I wasn't screwing around. It was one of my favorite tricks as a suit-wearing villain. Then I booted him in the stomach and started screaming like Walter Sobchak. You see what happens? Do you see what happens? Do you see what happens, Jimmy, when you fuck a stranger in the ass? Well, I didn't actually say that last line, but you know what I mean. The beatdown was drawing serious heat, and at that point I had the Midas touch of heelism. Everything I did made people boo. I then delivered the ultimate insult, according to Vince, when I grabbed a banana off the floor and shoved it in Snuka's mouth. Once again, after the cowardly sneak attack, I calmly straightened my tie, fixed my hair, and sauntered off the stage, leaving Superfly down and the crowd steaming. The next chapter in the story came on Raw the night after Mickey Rourke lost the Best Actor Oscar to Sean Penn. I don't know if the Academy voted against him after his red carpet WrestleMania challenge, but I felt that he should have won. In my opinion, his portrayal of Randy the Ram Robinson kicked Sean Penn's portrayal of Harvey's spoiled milk's ass all over the silver screen. But regardless of what I thought in real life, my character took great joy in Rourke's defeat, and I expressed this live on Raw. My foil that week was the returning Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, who received a hero's welcome from the WWE Universe, as they hadn't seen him in over 15 years. My idea to add him to the match appeared to be a smart one, for the fans were genuinely happy to see him, until I came into the picture. I waltzed on the stage like my name was Len Goodman, and I owned the damn place. I was in the promo zone at this point and cut an intense, albeit a little long-winded, speech about how Steamboat had sold out to the WWE when he became the Dragon in the 80s, and how he had now sold out for the second time by accepting an office job with the company. Now the loyal dog gets his bone by getting inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. You, Steamboat, are the ultimate hypocrite. Steamboat's face told a million tales as he raised the mic to his mouth. Ricky had never been known for his promos, but on this night he delivered like he was The Rock. He started by telling the story from my wildly successful Romana Clef, A Lion's Tale, about how I waited in line to get his autograph over 20 years ago at a World of Wheels show because he was my hero. Then he fast-forwarded to today and addressed what I'd become, how I'd embraced and then turned on the fans so many times, how I'd become the ultimate hypocrite. Then he finished with a killer go-home line. I am not a hypocrite, Jericho, but I am something you may never be, a WWE Hall of Famer. I'd been served, and the crowd loved it. Of course, they didn't love it when I popped Steamer in the head with the mic and threw him into the LED screen on the stage. I continued my onslaught, berating him incessantly and calling him Mr. Hall of Fame over and over. Then, of course, I straightened my tie and strutted off the stage to a litany of boos. The angle had gotten over better than we expected, and a big reason for that was the passion projected by Piper, Snuka, and Steamboat. These were main event players for the majority of their careers who had been reduced to bit players in the WWE for the last decade or so. But now that old fighting spirit to be the best had returned. We worked our asses off to make the match a true attraction for WrestleMania, and it became one. Then a few weeks before Mania, I heard that since the Oscar race was over, Mickey Rourke was going to appear after all. He was going to sit in the front row and be involved in the finish of the match, which meant my Hollywood coverage was back, baby. The match also had a major cherry on top, with the inclusion of Flair in the Legends Corner, his first appearance at Mania since his retirement match a year earlier. Everything was going my way. Everything, that is, until I had a confrontation with Flair on Raw that ended up getting me more heat than Miami. with Vince McMahon. Flair started the promo on Raw by accepting my challenge on behalf of his friends to a 3-on-1 match at Mania, guaranteeing he would be in their corner and that Mickey would be in the front row. I interrupted him from the production truck, where I was standing in front of TV screens showing highlights of Snuka, Steamboat, and Piper. I left the truck and walked down the halls of the backstage area, through the gorilla position and into the ring, all the while vilifying the legends with my diatribe. I boasted that I was going to beat them all at once, and there was nothing he could do about it. He told me I was wrong and then cut a classic Flair promo, describing how at the end of the match, all 5 of my opponents would be standing over my broken body while 70,000 people shouted, "Woo!" That's when I sucker-punched him in the forehead. Earlier in the day, Rick implored me to hit him as hard as I could, so I nailed him with all I had and he went down fast. I was surprised when he rolled over and blood was streaming down his face, but I went with it. There's an old trick in wrestling when someone is bleeding and you want to open the cut further, you keep striking it repeatedly. So I kept punching that cut as hard as I could, in the ring, out of the ring, on the announcement table, anywhere I could get a hold of him. I ripped his suit jacket off, after slowly removing my own, of course, pulled his tie over his head and threw his shoes into the crowd, Flair's idea. The bloodstains boomed on his dress shirt while I grabbed the camera off of a nearby cameraman's shoulder and lined him up. He pulled himself to his feet as I ran across the floor and slammed it into the top of his head. To add blood insult to blood injury, the camera split him wide open as well, and a crimson sheet cascaded down his face. He looked like he'd just stepped out of an abattoir. But I wasn't finished. I stood over his prone body, staring at the Rolex on his wrist, given to him by HBK after their classic Mania match. Earlier in the day, I'd pitched the idea to Vince of destroying that watch, but he balked as he felt nobody knew about the watch or cared. I argued that they would care if we brought it to their attention and made it into a big deal. Strangely, he agreed to let me smash the watch, though he didn't want to mention where it came from or the legit sentimental value it held for Rick. So when I pulled the fake Rolex off Rick's wrist, the real one was safely in the locker room, the crowd didn't respond as much as they would have if we had explained its significance beforehand. Even so, it was still Flair's Rolex, and there was a good reaction when I placed it on top of the steel stairs and slowly walked to the top step. I raised my foot over his biscuit like a guillotine, then dropped the blade of my heel into the glass faceplate and shattered it instantly. I stomped on it a few more times for good measure, and the Midas touch of heelism struck again. Huge chants of "You suck!" rang throughout the arena as I made my way back through Gorilla, satisfied with the job well done. Until I saw Vince's face, I could tell he was furious again. He started yelling about Flair getting color and bleeding all over the place, but this time I truly had nothing to do with it and didn't want to deal with him. So I walked out of Gorilla and headed to the trainer's room to wait for Rick. He was covered in so much blood that he looked like he'd been in the front row of a Guar concert as he sat down on the trainer's table to be examined. While the camera shot had busted open, Lagrika, his head for 15 inches, the punch I'd thrown that caused him to bleed in the first place had only left a small cut in the middle of his forehead. You could barely notice it. Word was getting back that Vince was freaking out about all the blood that had been shed, but since I was completely innocent this time, my attitude was, "My name's Paul, and this is between y'all." Unlike the Batista incident, this was an honest mistake, and if Vince felt differently, he could take it up with Flair. So I left the arena without saying a word and figured that was the end of it. But later that week I got a message that Vince wanted me to call him. That was never a good thing. If he wanted to talk to me about something good, he would have called me himself. Now that I knew I was in some sort of trouble, there was something that had been bothering me all week that I needed to investigate. Why had Flair bled so much from one punch? I'd been cut open from punches many times before, and most of the time they would quickly swell up and close on their own. It might leave a mouse or a welt, but whatever minor blood flow there was would usually stop fairly quickly. So it didn't make sense to me that Rick bled enough to stain his shirt after only one punch. The other thing that was really irking me was the small cut in the middle of Flair's forehead. It wasn't the type of cut you'd get from a punch, which would be more of a lump with an uneven abrasion running through it. This one was straight and neat, like it had been done surgically. Like with a razor blade. Had Flair done this to himself without telling me? I called Doc Amon and asked him what he thought.
Chris, I've been working in the WWE long enough to know that cut wasn't caused by a punch.
That was all I needed to hear. All evidence pointed to the fact that Flair had done this voluntarily without telling me. The crazy thing was I watched the segment a dozen times, and never once did I see his hand touch his forehead. But Flair was a wizard, and if he did do this to himself, he did it with such precision that it was impossible to pinpoint the exact moment when. Any way you slice it, no pun intended, I owed Vince a call and it was time to face the McMusic. He answered after the first ring and I could tell by the tone of his voice that he wasn't happy.
Chris, we need to discuss what happened last Monday and decide what the punishment is going to be. Rick was bleeding so bad that I almost pulled the plug on the segment and went to commercial early. You know how I feel about blood on the show, Chris. I'm going to have to fine you.
Are you effing kidding me? I was going to be fined again for somebody else getting busted open? Mortman.
Talk about blood money. I asked him why I was getting punished for hitting Flair with a stiff shot, something that happened every day in the line of duty.
Come on, Chris, that's bullshit and you know it. Flair got busted open,
Riker.
And in the old wrestling tradition, you kept punching him in the head trying to get him to bleed more.
Well, Vince was right about that.
Damn it, Chris, do you know how many sponsors we might lose because of this? It was old-school shit, and I don't allow it anymore. And the worst thing is you didn't even stop in Gorilla to talk to me about it. Did you think if you just ignored it that it would go away?
I should have learned my lesson to call him after doing so, saved my ass in the Batista incident. But I hadn't, and now the tide was turning completely against me. I went to my last resort.
Have you considered the fact that Rick might have done this to himself?
Yes, I've considered it, and you know what? I don't care. I can't fire him because he's not under contract.
Flair had cut a deal to work up to Mania only.
I can't fine him because he'll probably just go home, and I can't yell at him because it will just make him upset. Whether you knew about it or not, you went along with it and tried to punch the cut open further. So you're going to have to take the heat on this one.
Then he spouted out another classic Vince-ism.
Sometimes you have to eat shit and like it, Chris.
Oh, brother. Vince felt he had to set another example that to bleed on purpose was the ultimate sin in this new PG world, and I was the sacrificial lamb. There was no way out this time, but what would my fine be? Would he bring out the big guns like he had with Dave and drop the $100,000 hammer on me? Or would he just Eugene Levy the laughable $5,000 fine on me again?
I'm going to fine you $15,000, Chris, and this can't happen again.
It hadn't even happened once as far as I was concerned. But I weighed the amount of the fine on the scales of justice inside my head and realized I had come out okay. Vince could have easily decided that, as a second-time offender, I had crossed over into Batista territory and slipped me the big one. If I was playing fine or no fine and the banker offered me $15,000, I would have told Howie Mandel I was taking that briefcase right then and there. I hung up and resigned myself to the fact that I had been fined a total of $20,000 for bleeding, even though I hadn't lost a drop of my own blood. I guess I was eating a big mouthful of Vince's shit, but like Bill Murray found out while chewing on a log at the bottom of the pool in Caddyshack, it didn't taste too bad.
Chapter 17. Rourke's Dorks. The night before WrestleMania 25, the Legends and I were scheduled to have a rehearsal to discuss what we wanted to do in the match. The layout was pretty simple. I would beat Snuka in a minute, Piper in 2 minutes, and then Steamboat in about 5. Afterward, I'd then beat up Flair and challenged Rourke, who would enter the ring and hit me with a knockout punch. Mickey's spot was easy, but a rehearsal was necessary since it was his first time in the WWE. I was looking forward to finally meeting him after our Larry King confrontation and the subsequent weeks of build-up I'd done on Raw without him. I got to Reliant Stadium in Houston at midnight and walked out onto the massive set that had been constructed at one end of the field. I could see Rourke in the ring with his entourage, and they appeared to be the size of ants. And I started walking the 100 yards down the ramp when I ran into a WWE publicist.
"Hey, I just talked to Mickey, and he's mad at you," she said. "He thinks you have a real problem with him."
That surprised me.
"Well, did you tell him I don't?"
"No. Should I have?"
Yeah. I mean, what did she think the letters PR stood for in the first place? I was part of the public, and it was her job to relate to Mickey that I was a good guy. As I got closer to the ring, I could see Rourke staring at me and noticed that his entourage looked less like Turtle and Drama and more like the Delta Force. Three shredded bodybuilders glared at me with their heavily tattooed arms crossed in front of them. One was even wearing army fatigues for Pete Fornatale's sake. I knew my work was cut out for me as I climbed into the ring and greeted Mickey with a warm smile. "Hey, man, nice to finally meet you," I said cheerily and gave him the kind of hug you see two dudes into club do when they don't really know each other. I could sense the last thing he wanted to do was embrace me, and he couldn't pull away fast enough. He was about the same height as I and looked like he'd been through the ringer a time or two, with the wear and tear on his face to show it. His hair was braided with blue and green extensions and held up in a topknot a la Jericho circa 1999. His face was oddly puffy, and with his dyed black goatee, gold front tooth, and slight hint of B.O., he reminded me of an older Jack Sparrow. You savvy? He also looked tough as shit and ready to snap, not the kind of guy I wanted on my bad side, especially since I was supposed to be taking a punch from him the next day. We exchanged some small talk as Rourke's dorks kept staring at me, seemingly ready to pounce at any given moment. To make matters even worse, I recognized the one on the left as Frank Shamrock, and even though he was the shortest of the three, he was one of the toughest UFC fighters ever. What were these guys even doing here? I decided that the direct approach was in order. "Hey, man, I hear you're a little pissed off at me for the Larry King thing, but I want you to know that I was just putting on a show, you dig?" Rourke's face hardened as if he'd been waiting to get to the heart of the matter from the moment I got into the ring. "No, brother," he said with his distinct New York accent. "You don't say the things you said to me and not mean it. In my world, in the boxing world, when you say that shit, it's because you're looking for a fight." Wow, that explained why he'd never replied after I'd sent the text through Flair. He was legitimately pissed with me. "No, it's not like that, man. I was trying to get people interested in seeing us wrestle each other. I was just playing a character. Same thing you do when you do a movie." Here I was explaining acting and the inner workings of pro wrestling to a man who had just won a Golden Globe for Best Actor for his portrayal of a pro wrestler. After a few more minutes, I was finally able to convince him that I had been playing a role on the King Show. His face softened as he realized I was telling the truth. "So you're telling me that even though I'm the one who got nominated for an Oscar, you outacted me?" He burst out with a you-son-of-a-bitch laugh and gave me a bear hug for real this time. All the tension floated away and the entire vibe in the ring changed. He went on saying how he was so mad after the show and that he called his agents and demanded them to allow him to fight me. They of course said no, so he had planned another form of revenge. He pinned to the bruiser standing beside him and said, "I flew these guys into Houston on my own dime to make sure everything went smoothly. If you tried anything funny, I told them to kick the shit out of you." I was flattered, but told him that maybe he had overestimated me a little. "Mickey, to be honest, you didn't need to bring three guys. I'm sure just one of them would have sufficed." All of us laughed except the guy wearing army fatigues, an Israeli bounty hunter who didn't find any of this funny and continued to stare me down for the rest of the night. Vince made his way down to the ring, unaware of the confrontation Rourke and I had narrowly avoided, and went through his ideas for the match. As a wrestler, I would listen to what Vince wanted, think about the logistics of it, run through it once or twice, and move along. But as an actor, Mickey was much more concerned with camera angles and minor movements. He wanted to rehearse his punch over and over again, discussing his motivation, his positioning, everything. There would be no improv for this guy. Then we discussed how he was going to hit me. I told him not to worry about pulling the punch and just swing like he would in a boxing match. He shook his head and warned me, "I don't know about that. I'm Golden Glove's brother. If I hit you with this right hand, you're going to feel it." I convinced him that it was okay and told him he could hit me as hard as he wanted, as long as it looked good. After being walloped in the forehead for real by the 7-foot-tall Big Show, I thought I could take a punch from a 160-pound actor. After about a half hour of going over the punch spot a dozen times, Mickey was happy and he left ringside with his posse in tow. I went over to Vince and told him what had almost happened. "You know, Rourke hired those guys to kick my ass if I tried to double-cross him." Vince stared down the rampway at Rourke's gang.
Are you kidding me? Those guys?
He laughed. He motioned at Dean Malenko and Fit Finley, who were talking at ringside.
You, me, Finley, and Malenko would have beat the shit out of them.
I mean, look at that one guy. He's a midget. The midget Vince was referring to was Shamrock, the multiple-time UFC champion. I smiled at Vince and said, well, if anything goes down, I'll take Rourke and you take the midget.
Damn right I will, he murmured and swaggered out of the ring.
The next day when I showed up at the stadium, Mickey called me into his dressing room, still raving over my performance on Larry King. He told me I had what it took to make it as an actor and gave me a list of method books he wanted me to read. It was pretty fruit to get that kind of feedback from an Oscar-nominated thespian, even if the hint of B.O. remained, but the adulation didn't end there. He told me over and over that we should do a movie together, said I could stay at his house whenever I was in Hollywood, sent me a giant autographed poster of the wrestler, invited me to visit him on the set of Iron Man 2, and asked me to call him before my next audition so he could help me run through my lines. The footage of him knocking me out after the match, even though his feared right hand barely grazed the back of my head, made it onto all the Hollywood gossip shows, but I didn't quite get the mainstream exposure I'd expected. The majority of the media never even mentioned me by name. It was always the host saying something as simple as, Mickey Rourke gets the knockout punch at WrestleMania, while the footage ran of him KOing some unnamed fall guy. But I'm Chris Jericho. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter what my name is, The Rock, because the angle was a success, and that was all I cared about. Plus, I made a friend out of the deal, as Mickey and I exchanged numbers and kept in touch for months afterward, until we eventually lost contact. So, Mickey, if you're reading this, give me a call, and we'll do lunch, babe. While the angle had been built up great, the match itself went even better than I could have expected. It started off fairly slow, since Snuka couldn't move much, and Piper did the best he could. I beat them both quickly, but business was about to pick up, Jim Ross, when Steamboat got in the ring. Our styles meshed together perfectly, and he was the big surprise of the show, even though it wasn't much of a shock to see him steal it away from the rest of us. He was one of the absolute best performers in the history of the business, and it was a blast to work with him, both on a professional and a personal level. Steamboat was the second of my three major pro wrestling heroes that I got to work with, the first being HBK and the third being Owen Hart, who passed away before I had the chance to grapple with him, and it was a childhood dream come true to be in the ring with him at WrestleMania. It wasn't like Ricky's performance was good just for an old-timer. He exceeded everyone's expectations with his fluid, acrobatic style, and it seemed like he hadn't lost a step in the 10 years since he'd last wrestled. The crowd was going wild for him, erupting into a gigantic 70,000-strong chant of You Still Got It, as he nailed all of his signature moves, the double chop, the high arm drags, and, of course, the majestic crossbody from the top rope, which provided the biggest false finish of the match. But it wasn't enough to beat me, so the fans groaned in disappointment when I kicked out at 2.9 and hit him with a quick codebreaker for my third win of the night. Even though Ricky lost, the crowd was buzzing over his performance, and Vince was so impressed that he booked him as a wrestler and coach for months afterward to work with the young guys at live events. We wrestled each other around half dozen times, including single matches at the next PPV, and in Tokyo, Honolulu, and Greenville, South Carolina, which is where we had the best match of them all. I was scheduled to win, but South Carolina was one of Ricky's old NWA stomping crowds, and the crowd was going bonkers when he came to the ring. This was also the night the guy charged the ring from 20 rows out. Eventually, Ricky hit me with a high crossbody, and the fans were certain he was going to beat me. But just like at Mania, I kicked out in the nick of time and hit him with the codebreaker for the planned finish. But as I covered him, I told him, kick out, you got it? No matter what, kick out. Then I whispered sternly to referee and fellow Striper and Evil Dead fan, Charles Robinson, Ricky is going to kick out. Do not count to three. Ricky waited until the last microsecond and kicked out of my pin. Charles motioned that I had only scored a two count, and I went berserk. I had the crowd freaking out and right where I wanted them, so I kicked the rope and got in Charles' face as I came up with the new finish in my head. I wanted to pick up Steamboat for a body slam and have him roll me up for the pin, the exact finish of his famous WrestleMania 3 match versus Randy Savage, which is one of my all-time favorites. But my mind had gone completely blank, and I couldn't remember the term roll-up. I was flipping through my mental moves Rolodex, but the harder I thought, the less I remembered. The crowd was exactly where I wanted them, and I didn't have much time to waste, so I grabbed Steamboat by the hair and said under my breath, WrestleMania 3 finish. Of course, the dragon knew exactly what I meant, and rolled me up tightly. Charles counted to three, and the crowd erupted, ecstatic that their hero had vanquished the evil Jericho in their hometown. When I got to the back, Arn Anderson, who was running the show, was laughing.
"Damn it, Jericho, you dumb motherfucker," he said, clapping me on the back. "Even when we want to give you a win, you still won't take it. I wish you were around when I was working. I could have got a victory, too."
I joined in with Arn's laughter because he was right. But it was all worth it when Ricky came back through the curtain and shook my hand.
"Chris, I just want to tell you that it's a joy to work with you, and it's so damn easy. Thank you for helping me get back in the groove. I'll wrestle you anytime."
He gave me a hug and walked away. I stood there in that hallway with an ear-to-ear grin for a long time, having one of my childhood heroes thank me for helping him get back in the groove and telling me I was a joy to work with. Yeah, I'd have to say that even though I lost the match, I still won pretty damn big that night. Chapter 18, Santino Gump. I was happy with my performance at Mania and proud that all of our hard work had culminated into an entertaining 20 minutes that the fans enjoyed. Now it was time to relax for 24 hours. You see, we always say that WrestleMania is the Super Bowl of the WWE, and it is. But the big difference between our crown jewel and the NFL is that when the Super Bowl is finished, their players get to take some time to relax and go to Disneyland or whatever. But when WrestleMania is finished, we all get to go back to work the next day. Before we do, though, there's always a huge private party for all of us that starts as soon as Mania ends. It's always first class with gourmet food, full open bar, amazing decorations, and a killer live band to set the tone. Some bands were better than others, with Los Lonely Boys at one end of the spectrum, the Hillbilly Jim Band at the other, and the band that played one set dressed as AC/DC, Vince's favorite band, and the other dressed as the Rolling Stones, Vince's second favorite band, ended up somewhere in the middle. But this year, the entertainment was going to a whole new level. This year, it was all about Musclemania. This was a bodybuilding contest between Cody Rhodes and Santino Marella that was going to be held during the biggest and sole company party of the year. Only in the WWE, right? The seeds for the contest had been sown on an overseas tour when Cody told Santino that he had gotten fat and needed to shape up. Cody was instantly ambushed by catcalls and snide remarks from the rest of the crew who felt he was out of line. Or more likely, we were just bored and thought it was funny to gang up on him. Santino, of course, took great umbrage, try using that one on Words with Friends, kids, to this and bet he could get in better shape than Cody in time for Mania. Within minutes, the contest was booked for the post-show party. The judges were picked. Taker, Regal, JBL. The rules were set, and the T-shirts were printed featuring a knockoff of the famous Mega Powers Explode poster from Mania 5, with Santino in the Hogan spot and Cody in the Savage position. Both men dieted and trained as hard as they could, and on the night of the show, it looked like it was going to be a tight contest, even though Santino was on a roll as his sister Santina had already won the Divas title earlier in the night. I'll let Santino tell the story about why he was dressed up as a woman in his own book. It was also a pretty hard task having to explain why there was a guy in a dress parading around the ring with the women's title to Kid Rock. Yeah, that Kid Rock. I first met Kid years earlier at a joint MTV and WCW event in Cancun. Read all about it in my gladiator novel, A Lion's Tale, available in armor shops worldwide. And we'd been buds ever since. He had done a mini-concert at Mania earlier that night and invited me to come hang in his dressing room after we were both finished. We had a few beers while watching the show with his massive entourage, and even though Kid was a big wrestling fan, he was a little weirded out by the tranning in the ring. "Oh, he ain't no tranny. He's my brother," I said, and sipped my PBR. Santino winning the Divas title was the silly side of wrestling, But the Shawn Michaels and Undertaker match was the epitome of what the business is all about. As a matter of fact, I'll go on record and say it's the best match I've ever seen in my life. A 5-star clinic that was perfect in every way. Kid and I watched it, cheering along like 2 14-year-olds getting our first taste of the WWE. We gasped at the intensity of the battle, gave each other high fives at the false finishes, and practically hugged each other in fear when Taker did a dive out of the ring and landed directly on his head. Both of us jumped off the couch and waited in silence, praying that he would move his legs, his arms, anything.
"Come on, big man, get up, get up!"
Kid kept repeating under his breath until Taker finally rose to his feet. We sank back into the couch with a big sigh of relief. When Mania finished, Kid and I and his entourage headed to the after party and set up shop in the corner of the hall. We drank more beers, told jokes, and had a great conversation about everything from our initial meeting in Cancun to our second meeting in Vancouver, when I got trapped under the stage after introducing him on Raw. Confused? Get my self-help book, Undisputed, for your Kindle now. His dear departed sidekick, Joe C., how AC/DC was the best rock band of all time, and the pros and cons of smoking weed. Suddenly, an announcement was made. Musclemania was about to begin. The DJ stopped the music and the live band started laying down some grooves to set the scene. Kid wasn't too sure what was going on, but when the band started rocking, his ears perked up like a Pavlov dog and he hit the stage. He set himself up behind some bongo drums and began jamming along. Suddenly, the music stopped as Taker grabbed the mic and called Cody and Santino to the stage. Kid looked on, dejected, wondering why the vibe had been interrupted.
"What's going on, man?" he asked me.
"Why did the music stop?"
"Those guys are going to have a bodybuilding contest," I explained.
He looked at me like I was a devil without a cause and watched what was transpiring on stage. Cody and Santino had taken off their clothes and were flexing their muscles, wearing nothing but skimpy posing trunks. Well, Santino was, but poor Cody was wearing a pair of cheap Speedos and looking like he was going to puke, while the mostly male audience stood at the front of the stage, hooting and hollering. Triple H was the MC calling out traditional poses, which the two performed dutifully, as Vince, Taker, Cena, and Kane cheered from the front row, laughing hysterically. Kid's face scrunched up in disgust like he had a spider in his mouth as he watched the two oiled-up, half-naked men flexing and writhing on the stage. When Santino hit a crab and the audience cheered wildly as if he were Mandy Mellons taking off her top at the Cheetah Club on a Friday night, Kid Rock decided he had seen enough. "That does it. This sucks. I'm out of here," he said, and without another word walked straight out the door, his entourage filing out behind him with no questions asked. I haven't seen or heard from him since. One of the biggest and most decadent rock stars of all time, a man who had seen and taken part in the kind of sexual debauchery that would have made Caligula blush, had finally reached his decency limit and been completely disgusted by the atrocity known as Musclemania. World Wrestling Entertainment, 1. Early Morning Stoned Pimp, 0. Poor Cody didn't stand a chance at Musclemania and was booed out of the building. He was nothing more than the straight man in this comedy duo. Santino, on the other hand, was the star of the show and walked away with the 7-foot-tall JBL-designed trophy, adorned with tiny female sports figures, ice skaters, gymnasts, ballet dancers, etc. It was no surprise Santino was voted the winner, for he was probably the most popular guy on the entire roster. Everybody loved him because he was so ridiculously goofy in every way. As a person, he was impossible to dislike. Great sense of humor, laid-back vibe, and the best stories ever. He'd seemingly done everything in his life, so I called him Santino Gump. As I was writing this modern-day catcher in the rye, I couldn't remember all of the jobs he told me he had over the years, so I texted him to get the details. This was his response, verbatim. "I've been a dishwasher, busboy, bartender, bouncer, master of ceremonies, scrap metal worker, sub-sandwich maker," his autographed picture still hangs in a Mr. Sub in Toronto, "retail seller in the mall, male stripper, singing telegram delivering Power Ranger, personal trainer, account manager in a telecom company, event marketing coordinator, mechanical installer, customs broker, ad salesman for a magazine, high school teacher, truck refrigeration parts delivery boy,
warehouse worker, roadie for a circus, landscaper, pizza shop worker, pro fighter, and of course, pro wrestler.
He knew everybody and had seen everything like the WWE's version of Bob Sakamano. Plus, he had the strangest of talents. He was a great speedwalker, for real. He had entered speedwalking contests and won. He was great at rolling, and I'm not talking about joints. I'm talking about actually getting on the floor and rolling back and forth. I've seen him roll across the dressing room with perfect speed and precision like a buzz droid. Who does that? And how do you find out you're good at rolling in the first place? He would go to a club and glide across the dance floor like Danny Zuko, yelling at the top of his lungs, "Here it comes! Here it comes!" Then jump in the air and land in a full split. Then he would pop straight back up onto his feet and keep on dancing like Jimmy Hart and the Gentrys. He also knew exactly how to play his character for maximum laughs at all times. He purposely mispronounced names, calling Raw guest host Snoop Dogg Snoopy the Dog while dressed in full Charlie Brown regalia was my personal favorite. Wore his hair in a goofy mullet and faux hawk combo, and drew a unibrow on his forehead every night for maximum comedic effect. He formed a partnership with the Glamazon Beth Phoenix and christened their team Glamorella. He seemingly tore his ball bag while attempting Melina's splits on the apron ring entrance. He won the IC title and claimed he would beat the Honky Tonk Man's record as the longest reigning IC champion, then introduced the honky meter to measure his progress. He only kept the title for like 12 of the 64 weeks necessary to beat the record, but was so over that the fans loved him even more when he lost. Actually, they cheered him no matter what. When he won, when he lost, when he broke the record for the quickest elimination in Royal Rumble history. Kane got rid of him in 2 seconds, and Santino protested, "I wasn't ready," all the way to the back. When he seemingly won the 2010 Royal Rumble or was in the final two of the Elimination Chamber in 2012, he got astonishing ovations from the fans begging him to win the big one. His character was bulletproof in that he could do anything and still stay over. The rarest of rare things in pro wrestling. Then there was his actual in-ring work, which was the most entertaining part of his character, because you never knew when he was trying to be bad or when he was just bad. He would jump toward his corner to make the hot tag and land 2 feet away from his partner, with his hand extended like Charlie Brown sliding into home plate. This was on purpose. He'd do a flying headbutt that looked, as Arn described it, like a salmon swimming upstream to spawn. There would be no grace whatsoever, no technique at all. He would simply jump in the air straight as a pencil and drop straight down like a brick. That was not on purpose. He'd do an elbow drop where he would mime to the audience that he was sharpening his elbow like a pencil before he dropped it. That was on purpose. Then he would give a totally awkward stiff-legged hip toss that looked ridiculous and made Cena and me laugh every time. That was not on purpose. Then there were his famous finishing maneuvers. The Cobra was a ridiculous move where he would turn his hand into a snake with a series of taps to various parts of his arm and then bite his hapless victim. He upgraded the move a few months later when he began reaching down his pants to pull out a full-length spandex glove painted to look like a cobra. That's when you knew shit was getting real. In typical Santino fashion, the move got over huge in spite of looking completely stupid. Heel after heel was vanquished after being struck in the throat by the dreaded snake sock puppet. When Santino got bored with the Cobra, he began working on his new finish, the Maserati Clutch, which was a high-risk running top rope submission maneuver. He got the mic at live events to warn his opponents that when he made the sign of a giant M with his arms, "That stands for Maserati," and then locked his hands into a clutch, "That stands for clutch." The end was near. During the course of the match, he would signal for the devastating move and get cut off every time. We never did see Santino unleash the Maserati clutch, which is probably best for the survival of mankind. Half of the stuff he did was comedic genius and the other half was rotten, but it still made people laugh, so his matches were always entertaining. Unfortunately, not everyone felt that way. He was in a tag team match against Cody Rhodes and Bobby Hawley in Vienna that didn't turn out the way it had been planned. According to Bob, Santino made a few mistakes during his comeback that caused some timing issues and screwed up the match. Bob was quite high-strung with a hair-trigger temper and was fed up with Santino's perceived incompetence, so he went off on him in the dressing room afterward.
Santino, you are the absolute shits. You are the worst performer I've ever been in the ring with. The absolute worst.
Bob Hawley had been around for a long time, so for him to say Santino was the worst opponent he'd ever faced covered a lot of territory and was a huge insult. But Santino didn't think so, and